The Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail stretches 3,700 miles from Wood River, Illinois, to the mouth of the Columbia River in Oregon. It's one of two National Historic Trails to pass through Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll celebrate the 50th anniversary of the National Trail System. I'll talk with Neil Bedlin, Chief of Interpretation of the Lewis and Clark Trail, and Keith Bystrom, an Iowan who traveled the trail. Later in the hour, many communities in rural Iowa have been losing population, but that's not always bad. I'll talk with two Iowa researchers who are studying communities that have lost population but gained quality of life. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Many communities in rural Iowa lose population every year. There are some communities that have gotten smaller and better, seeing an improvement in quality of life. We'll find out what these communities are doing right later in the hour. But first, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the National Trail System. In a few minutes, I'll talk with Keith Bystrom, who recently retired from Iowa State University and set out to travel the Lewis and Clark Historic Trail, which stretches 3,700 miles from Wood River, Illinois, to the mouth of the Columbia River in Oregon, following, of course, in the footsteps of the Corps of Discovery expedition of Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. The Lewis and Clark Trail is one of two National Historic Trails that passes through Iowa. The other is the Mormon Trail. And with me right now is Neil Bedlin, Chief of Interpretation for the Lewis and Clark Historic Trail. Hello, Neil.
Hello, Charity. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I always like talking about trails.
Great. Well, before we focus on the Lewis and Clark Trail, again, this is the 50th anniversary of the National Trail System. Many of those are wilderness trails. But give me a little bit of history of when the National Trail System was founded.
Sure. Well, the whole concept was brought to Congress in 1965 by President Johnson. And in his speech, he mentioned the need for conservation and preservation of natural beauty, and to also look at different ways that people can experience parks. And so in 65, it formed a committee. There was a committee formed, and it wasn't until 1968 that Congress actually passed the National Trail System Act. And so what that did is it allowed Americans to be able to hike, walk, horseback, ride bikes, or even use highways to experience America in a different way. And so it was really looking at changing the way people view using parks, where we normally see them as a defined boundary, and looking at it as a linear boundary or a linear park along something. So in 1968, it was signed by Congress, and then that established the National Scenic Trails. But it wasn't until 1978, President Carter signed the Historical Trails. And so that's where Iowa gets involved with that because of the Lewis and Clark and Mormon Trails.
Well, and the National Historic Trails, they're a little different than the scenic trails. I mean, with the scenic trails, you might want to go get lost in the wilderness and hike a couple hundred miles, that kind of thing. With the historic trails, what was the concept?
Well, pretty much after the scenic trails were established, you know, the scenic trails are a surface trail where you could park or and get off and ride, hike the trail. For example, the Appalachian Trail, there's a surface trail. But a lot of states saw the need that they may not have a surface trail designated, but they have a lot of historical needs that need to be interpreted and recreational opportunities. And so that's where the historic trails really brought in a lot more states involved in the trail system process. And it's a great way of when I think about it, what better way of doing outdoor recreation and learning at the same time?
And with the historic trails, I mean, the ones that pass through Iowa, the narrative is pretty clear. I mean, we're following the core of discovery with the Lewis and Clark Trail. We're following the Mormons as they made their way with their hand carts across the United States with the Mormon Trail. But these trails also go through very developed areas, through towns, along highways. So in following the Lewis and Clark Trail, we'll talk more about what it's like on the ground in a few minutes, but how do you make that a different experience rather than driving along a highway?
Well, you can experience it in a lot of different ways, and that's the great thing about the historical trails, at least for the Lewis and Clark Trail. You can experience it on bike or on water or by car, but traditionally, or where we see the most people visiting the trail or experiencing the trail, is by car in the auto tour route. And so there's a, even though the trail is 3,700 miles long, we have over 6,000 miles of auto tour route where you're driving a route that parallels the historic route. And along those routes, there are great sites that people could visit and learn more about Lewis and Clark. So we call a lot of those sites our main pearls along the route, and those are visitor centers, state parks, and other areas where you could get out of the car and hike and experience the trail in that way.
And it seems like, although this is the 40th anniversary of the historic trails, there has been a lot of development along the Lewis and Clark Trail, really in the last 20 years. Can you tell me about some of the visitor centers that have been more recent additions?
Sure. Well, during the bicentennial, was pretty much a large rush of getting different, making sure the trail was interpreted at different states.
And that's the
So,
bicentennial of the Core of Discovery, right? Not
sorry.
of the United
Oh,
States, right?
no, sorry. During that time, there was a lot of areas that developed visitor centers and looked at providing a way to provide interpretation to the traveling public along the entire route. And so Iowa has a lot of great sites that were developed around that time. And so, like the Sioux City Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center and the Lewis and Clark State Park near Onawa and the Western Historic Trail Center.
And you work in Omaha primarily, right?
Yep. I work, the actual headquarters for the entire Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail is based in Omaha. We're right on the riverfront at the bottom steps of the Bob Carey Pedestrian Bridge, one of the few sites you could step in both Iowa and Nebraska at. And so, yep, we're right on the trail here, and that's where our headquarters is.
Do you have a favorite spot on the Lewis and Clark Trail?
That's a great question, and it changes quite often because it all depends. But growing up in Nebraska, I'm always a fan of the ocean, getting out to see the ocean because I didn't grow up around it. But the ocean or the Rockies in the Lolo area is two of my favorites. And then also the Missouri River Breaks is an amazing scenic experience too.
Well, and of course, you're always thinking about the history at the same time. So when you're on the Missouri River and thinking about Lewis and Clark, what do you think a traveler should be thinking about at that moment?
Well, I think it's important that they look and learn more about the Lewis and Clark and the Lewis and Clark story, but also learn about the native perspective of the story because the story has a lot to teach us. But it's also important to know that even though Lewis and Clark traveled these routes, many of these routes were known for thousands of years by Native Americans.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. I want to bring somebody else into the conversation now who has recently traveled the trail. Keith Bystrom is here with us, a retired associate counsel of the Office of the University Counsel at Iowa State University. He traveled the Lewis and Clark Trail after retirement. Hello, Keith.
Hello, how are you, Charity?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
And
Hello, Neil. How are you?
good, good.
Keith, this was kind of a dream of yours for a long time, wasn't it?
Yes, it was something that I wanted to do in the bicentennial with my family, but they wanted to fly out to the Northwest to a conference I was going to, and so I put it off until 2017.
Well, okay, when you proposed that idea to your family, which they rejected, but tell me what you were hoping to do.
Well, there was a national meeting of the National University College and University Attorneys out in Vancouver, and I just wanted to drive out there along the trail. I wasn't even expecting to be able to spend a long time, just drive it and see some of the main sites along the way. That didn't happen. I was just planning a family summer trip.
Right. So did they reject the idea because they didn't want to be on the road that long, or was this just too nerdy an idea for the rest of the family that they didn't want to plunge into the depths of the history of Lewis and Clark?
Well, they all know my penchant for wanting to stop at historical markers, and I'm usually the last one out of the museum when we stop at a historical museum. And so they knew that if I said it was going to be a week, that I probably would stop so many places that it would be much longer than that. And they probably are right. I was on the trail in 2017 for a total of 55 days.
Wow. Well, we will talk about some of the highlights of that. But before we have to let Neil go, Keith obviously really explored this trail. I'm guessing a lot of other people just drop in and out. Can you give me an idea of how people use this trail?
Yeah, primarily people cross it or typically don't do a start to finish of the entire trail. There are places or companies that provide a whole tour of the trail. And we've talked with people that have done the whole trail, and they've said it usually takes about 16 days. And like Keith said, it all depends on how much time you spend at each one of the areas. But I'd definitely recommend looking at day trips, at least getting out and trying and experiencing part of the trail close to you within a day or two drive. There's something in every section of the trail, it has something to offer someone.
All right. Well, Neil, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Neil Bedlin is Chief of Interpretation for the Lewis and Clark Historic Trail. In just a moment, Keith Bystrom and I will be talking about his 55 days on the Lewis and Clark Historic Trail. And we'll also get a little advice for if you want to go out and experience the trails of Iowa, where should you go and how should you prepare for that? That's coming up in a little while. Later on in the hour, we'll talk about rural communities that are shrinking smart. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the 50th anniversary of the National Trail System. And in particular, we're focusing in on the Lewis and Clark Historic Trail that stretches 3,700 miles from Wood River, Illinois, to the mouth of the Columbia River in Oregon. Of course, it follows the Corps of Discovery expedition of Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. And with me right now is Keith Bystrom. He is retired associate counsel from the Office of the University Counsel at Iowa State University. And in his retirement, he traveled the Lewis and Clark Trail for 55 days. So, Keith, tell me, when did you become fascinated by the Corps of Discovery?
Well, probably, I grew up in Nebraska in North Platte on the Platte River, but I learned a little bit about it in history, but you don't learn the details of it. But then, probably my biggest the biggest thing that happened was my mom back in 1997 gave me Ambrose's book, Undaunted Courage, with a little note that I would love it because she knew my kind of interest in history. I read that and became fascinated, and then looked at a lot of the bicentennial things. We actually went to a few bicentennial events close by, and I came over to Omaha on Lewis and Clark Landing for a postage stamp revealing that the United States Postal Service had with Lewis and Clark stamps, and visited some of the other sites along the Missouri River between Nebraska and Iowa. And then it kind of got put on hold until I was retiring in 2016, and I rejuvenated that interest. It was at the top of my bucket list, and so I wanted to do it.
Well, exciting. So you set out by car, and you weren't able to do the entire trail in one fell swoop, although in total you spent about 55 days on the trail. Let's talk about some of the highlights of the trail. I mean, including the beginning of the trail, where it starts. That's a place where a lot of people gather to mark the anniversaries of the expedition, right?
Yes, the beginning of the trail is across the river, the Mississippi River, from St. Louis, in a place that the Corps called Camp Du Bois. Camp Du Bois was where they spent their winter getting ready for the expedition, and then they took off from there on May 14th. Of 2004.
Of 1804.
Excuse me, yes, 1804.
So as you thinking about people in Iowa, can you tell me where the must-visit point is that's closest to Iowa or even in Iowa for you?
In Iowa? And close. You really can't differentiate, I don't think, between Iowa and Nebraska, because they're camping on both sides wherever they were going. But probably the places that people would go the most would be in Nebraska City. There's an interpretive center, and then in the national headquarters in Omaha, as well as the State Trail Center in Council Bluffs. There is a longtime monument on the bluffs just north of Council Bluffs that was put in the WPA days in the 1930s. That is a monument to Lewis and Clark, and it overlooks the river and Omaha Epley Airfield. It's a beautiful place. And then going up the river, a lot of people will go to Lewis and Clark State Park near Ottawa. That's where they have a replica of the keelboat, which really wasn't a keelboat; it was a barge because it was a flat bottom. It's built by a man from Butch Beauvoir from Council Bluffs. He's built about 15 replicas and. Over 400 models of all of the boats associated with Lewis and Clark.
Right. Well, and that flat bottom was extremely important because the Missouri River is so wide but so shallow, right?
Yes. It was very wide and lots of sandbars. It wasn't channelized like it is now. Then the other place that in Iowa that people can easily go to and spend more than a day is the bend of the river at Sioux City. There's lots of things there with Sergeant Bluff and
the Sergeant Floyd Monument up on the bluff.
Yeah.
So
there's interpretive centers there that are very nice.
All right. Now, of course, then Lewis and Clark and their expedition, they headed out west, and you headed out west as well. And just give me a couple of highlights, maybe two of your favorite things as you got further west.
Okay. One of my favorite places to just look at the river is near Sioux City. It's west of Ponca State Park, and it's called Mulberry Bend Overlook. It's a they've built a on the top of a bluff. It's the place where if you look to the west, the river is the same as it would have been 200 years ago. But if you look to the east, that's where the channelization starts, and so it's narrower, and the water is running faster. So it's just a beautiful spot. You could spend, but they had some trails there. I did a little bit, spent the whole day there, and it's a beautiful place.
Well, and it sounds probably like that's a place where you can, especially if you're looking west, you can almost trick yourself into feeling like it's 1804.
Right, right. And there's a section of the National Scenic Parks there that addresses the Missouri River Basin. There's two segments, right below Gavin's Point Dam and then behind Lewis and Clark Lake, where they haven't channelized and they've basically let the river flow, although of course with the dams they can let a lot more water come down than what might have come down in the past. They at least manage the water.
So what did it feel like for you when you reached the end of the trail, when you got to the Columbia River?
Well, it was kind of an emotional point to go up to kind of follow along the Washington side of the river. There's a number of sites you can stop. The end is Cape Disappointment, which, by the way, was named Cape Disappointment long before Lewis and Clark got there, because so many ships tried to come in and would falter at the what they call the Columbia Bar, a huge sandbar that wrecked millions or thousand ships, maybe. But Cape Disappointment is a high point, and if you go up there, they have just many overlooks where you can look out, and there you see the Pacific Ocean. And it was kind of emotional, thinking, what did Lewis and Clark think when they reached here and they reached the destination? Of course, they knew by then that there was no overland, or there was no Northwest Passage that they could go by water to the Pacific Ocean. They learned that at probably the highlights of what I did, and that's Lemhi Pass, which is the pass crosses the Continental Divide between Montana and Idaho. And it is kind of, it's a gravel road to get up there. They do have some campsites when you get to the top, but I was there about an hour before sunset. And, you know, I knew, because one of the things I did is I took Gary Moulton's abridged version of the Lewis and Clark journals with me. And I'd read along the day for the areas where I was traveling, exactly what Lewis and Clark were doing at that time. And they were thinking that when they got to the top of this Lemhi Pass, they would look out and maybe see the Pacific Ocean, but certainly see the Columbia River and their path to the Pacific Ocean.
And
when
they got to the top, they did not.
they did not. They saw snow-capped mountains as far as they could see. Those were the Rockies and the Bitterroot.
Well, Keith Bystrom, it sounds like a trip of a lifetime. Thank you so much for sharing your adventure with us.
Well, I'm pleased to talk about it, and I appreciate having the opportunity to do so.
Keith Bystrom, retired from Iowa State University, he traveled the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail for 55 days after retirement. And if you're feeling inspired to get out and explore a little bit, maybe enjoy one of the national trails or explore the trails right here in Iowa, we have somebody joining us who can give us a little bit of advice. Brian Morelli has led many backpacking adventures in and out of state. He's an adjunct instructor in the Lifetime Leisure Skills Program at the University of Iowa and a reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Hello, Brian.
How are you doing today, Charity?
Good. Thank you so much for being here. And I think in talking about the Lewis and Clark Historic Trail, obviously there are places along the trail where you can get lost in the wilderness and really feel what it felt like to be on that core of discovery. But here in Iowa, the trail doesn't necessarily take you into the wilderness. So I would love to talk a little bit about some of the places in Iowa where you really feel like you can get lost in the wilderness and experience Iowa's landscape as it once was. There are a few of those locations around the state. Brian, what are some of your favorite places to hike in Iowa?
Well, Yellow River State Forest is a pretty rustic and remote area in northeast Iowa. There's hiking, and people go up there for trout fishing and camping. And there's actually about a 13-mile backpacking loop with some backcountry sites you can only get to on foot. So you don't need to carry in your tents and sleeping bags and everything. And that's really beautiful and kind of goes up and down the valleys and the bluffs and so forth. So it's some great scene, great overlooks, and a lot of nice foliage in the fall.
Right, and that's up in the Driftless region, right?
Yeah. And that's another one, I guess I would, Backbone State Park has some really nice trails. That's over near Manchester. There's a loop around the lake there that's about 6 or 8 miles. The last time I went in winter, and we tried to, so there's like this spur, how it gets its name, the backbone, there's this trail that goes out over the spine of this ridge, and then it kind of descends down, but it makes a loop, and then you go back, and then you kind of continue on the trail. But we tried to kind of cut across and sort of bushwhack our way to find the other part of the trail. I was with some friends, and we actually found the trail, but we ended up taking it the wrong way. And then we're like, oh, let's just go this way. And this is in the middle of winter, so we were beaten by Backbone that time. So which is kind of nice, I suppose. It's kind of good to get put in your place every once in a while.
It's true. Well, in both of the places you've mentioned so far, I mean, people talk about Iowa as being flat, but you've picked two areas of Iowa where there's a lot of topography. And of course, Backbone State Park is our oldest state park in Iowa.
Yeah, I think it was at like 1920 or 1922 that it was established. Yeah, that's my understanding as well.
And it really is a place with some impressive impressive topography. You can see the geology of the state when you go to Backbone. So where else do you like to go in the state?
Well, I mean, my backyard is eastern Iowa, so Hickory Hill Park in Iowa City is probably the place I go to most often, just because it's maybe 5-10 minutes from my house, and I just got a new dog, so we've been going there quite a bit. And that's there's miles and miles of trails there, and they're actually doing some work to create new trails, which is kind of cool to explore different parts of the park. Lake McBride recreation area and state park is not too far away. That has there's this really fun spillway where the lake spills into the Iowa River, and it's a lot of fun to take your kids there because you can go, you can kind of people fish, and you can also kind of like walk through, kind of hop across the rocks to get across the spillway, and then you kind of climb up to this this overlook and kind of can see both the lake and the river at the same time. It's a cool place to go at sunset. Makokata Caves.
Makokata Caves also. I was going to ask you, since you've led a lot of backpacking expeditions, so once you build up your muscle in Iowa hiking some of these shorter trails, you've done a number of the national trails. Where have you been? Where have you hiked?
So as far as national trails, I've hiked on the Appalachian Trail, not the whole thing. The whole thing is about 2,200 miles from Maine to Georgia. I've hiked in Pennsylvania and Maryland, West Virginia, Virginia, and I've hiked a little bit up north in New Hampshire and Connecticut and Vermont. That's a lot of fun. As far as like the national trails, I don't want to say it's definitely challenging, but it's maybe more doable than some of the other ones when you might think of like the Continental Divide Trail or the Pacific Coast Trail, Pacific Crest Trail, because there's a lot of, it goes through towns, so there's places to resupply. There's also a lot of shelters, really well, like new newer built shelters where you can kind of hang out for the night, and you don't, you know, you might not need a tent, especially if you're in a small group of one or two people. There's usually enough room.
Well,
if you're in a larger group, you know, you might have to set up tents.
Right. We only have about a minute left, Brian,
yeah.
But for some people, have the idea of backpacking, carrying everything you need on your back, is pretty daunting for a lot of people. But if you're physically able and interested, what would you say in 30 seconds is the reason to strap that back on that pack on your back and head out there?
I mean, I think it's just getting back to nature, and for me, it's kind of a recharge, and just kind of you put back, you know, set aside your devices, you set aside all the acrimony around politics of the world, and just kind of get lost in the woods and sort of just kind of get back to basics, you know, starting a fire, cooking, just sort of exploring, and just being, you know, a curious human being.
Brian, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Brian Morelli has led many backpacking adventures. He's an adjunct instructor in the Lifetime Leisure Skills Program at the University of Iowa. He's also a reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about Iowa communities that are shrinking smart. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Rural Iowa has been losing population for decades now. Many communities are smaller than they once were, and that's a challenging situation for any town. But some towns have managed to improve quality of life even while they've become smaller. A team of Iowa State University researchers has set out to try to understand what's happening in these communities in the hopes that it can be replicated in many small towns in Iowa. With me is Sarah Hamida, Assistant Professor in Community and Regional Planning, also Assistant Professor of Sustainable Environments at Iowa State University. Hello, Sarah.
Hi.
Thank you for being here today.
Glad to be here.
Kimberly Zarikor is also here, Associate Professor in Architecture at Iowa State University. Hello, Kimberly.
Hi.
Thank you for being here. And they're part of a team that has been studying the 99 communities in the Iowa Small Town Poll, identifying towns that are shrinking smart. And Kimberly, let me start with you. Let's talk a little bit about definitions. How do you define shrinking smart?
Hi, Charity. So our research is about places where, as communities lose population, they still report metrics on quality of life as stable, improving, and getting better over time. And so we're thinking about these places as towns that make good decisions, are putting resources to efforts and programs that have a real result in terms of people's feelings about the town, their outlook about their town, and what we use as a general idea of quality of life.
Okay, and so the 99 communities in the Iowa Small Town Poll are communities with populations between 500 and 10,000 in 1990. So they've been, many of them have been shrinking over time. Give me, when you talk about quality of life, can you give me just a few examples of what some of those metrics are?
Yeah, sure. So some of the things that we're looking at are people's ideas about their jobs, about their medical care, about the quality of childcare in their community, senior services, how well the local government represents them and how well it functions, the K through 12 schools, and then also their housing and what are their options and what's the quality of the available housing. So those are seven measures that we're looking at in our poll data.
All right. And is there also a more ephemeral measure of just how do you feel about your town?
Yeah. So the small town poll has many questions. And one of the ones that we think is very predictive of people's overall feelings are their outlook towards the future. So people who are optimistic about their town, who speak in generally good terms about, their lifestyle, the people around them, the services that they have, this is how we think about quality of life.
All right. And I understand that there are three phases to this research. First, starting with the small town poll and those questions, figuring out which communities could be identified as shrinking while improving quality of life. And Sarah, then in the second part of this research, you led a team that went into a handful of these communities, right?
Yes, that's right.
All right. So tell me, when you went to these communities, what were you looking for?
So the reason we went to these communities was that the population lost, we had three measures of measuring and defining smart shrinkage, but we wanted to find the reasons. Why is it that we realized they are shrinking in a smart way? So we used a sociological framework, entrepreneurial social infrastructure, to explain, find the causes of shrinkage from the data that we had, but to verify that and to understand the reasons behind smart shrinkage, we went to five of these communities. We conducted extensive interviews with stakeholders, with leaders, with the active residents of these communities, asking all kinds of questions that cover three main domains. Number one, what are your perceptions about your shrinkage? Do you even see yourself as a shrinking community? Number two, what are your perceptions of the quality of life measures? How do you feel about those services, infrastructure, so on and so forth? Number three, what is it that you're actually doing? What actions are you taking? Who is involved? Who is not involved? What processes are you taking that gets you the results that you have, such as city beautification projects, such as new investments, different kinds of changes?
Okay, and I can imagine some people living in smaller communities or who have connections with small communities, and I think we all do in Iowa, might be thinking, well, isn't there a lot of luck here? I mean, sometimes towns shrink for different reasons, or something traumatic will happen with something closing down and losing a lot of jobs all at once. Did you think about luck when you were looking at these different communities, Sarah?
Actually, yeah, we did think about the context that would be the proxy of what we thought, what we were perceiving as luck. So we did look at the economic structure and the spatial structure, the context where these cities, where these small towns were located in. That was our factor of luck. What we found, interestingly, was that there was really no particular pattern that we could not say that, oh, these smart shrinking small towns are closer to big metro areas or relatively large metro areas, or that these smart shrink towns are located in a certain part of Iowa or have access to different types of economic employers or structures. So we did take into account that fact, different factors of luck. We realized that there is more into smart shrinkage in terms of process and actions than just luck.
Well, I think that's heartening to hear, to know that actually things that people who live in these towns can do can make a difference. So you identified some of those actions, and I realize the research is ongoing, but what are some of the actions that really do seem to make a difference?
I would say the largest, the most common theme that we found in terms of explaining the actions was the existence of champions. And champions wouldn't be just an individual or a group of people. Champions are these measures of social capital manifestation that translates into certain groups being shaped and sometimes changing. It's not like they always have the same form. But we found that sometimes in some of these smart shrinking towns, we have local governments acting as the champion through some phases. In some of these towns, we have non-governmental organizations, community foundations, for example, acting as champion. In some of them, a combination of private business owners, more successful private business owners, becoming the champion and energizing everybody else, or at least a large group of people in the town, getting them behind different projects. So I would say that's the most consistent explanation that we came across.
All right. So when you're talking about champions, you're talking about individuals who can energize other people and really lead change in a community?
Yes. The community definitely has to be open to those new ideas. That's something that our entrepreneurial social infrastructure framework showed us, that in the responses to Iowa small town poll surveys, residents of these communities were saying that we are open to new ideas and compared to other kinds of towns that we have. When we go to this town, that we see that, yes, these champions have a higher chance of getting acceptance for the new ideas, for organizing a new event, for example, for fundraising for different projects, for talking about some of the things that would be controversial in the beginning, but then the community would talk it through. And as I said, sometimes it's just one person, sometimes it's a group of people, and sometimes it's a government entity.
Interesting. And I can imagine that that snowballs. Once you have a leader that starts to get people excited, then the reach extends, right?
Definitely. Yes.
All right. Well, I would love to talk examples. And I don't know which one of you wants to dive in with this, but I know one of the communities that you studied was Sheffield, Iowa. And this is a community, you mentioned private business owners can be these champions and leaders. And that was the case in Sheffield, right?
That's right.
All right, so tell me what happened in Sheffield.
So this is Kimberly. I'm going to jump in. And Sheffield's an interesting case because it has a very large employer on the edge of town, and that's the Sukup Corporation. And this company has been growing, and it has a big part in the community. But I think it's also important to say that part of the research that we've done is that the community itself also has people in town who act as champions, who are really optimistic about the future. And it's not completely led from the company. And this is important because if there's too much domination, let's say, by one entity, this can have the negative effect of making other people feel that they don't have a part in that future. So in Sheffield, we see a couple things. We see that the company has done a lot of philanthropy in the town. They have donated and contributed to things like the community swimming pool and helped with the parks and some of the public spaces. And they've also done infrastructure projects that have been a big benefit. But Sheffield also has a strong library that has good leadership. They also have a city council and a mayor who are very active in promoting the local businesses. The mayor has a business himself in town. And we think that there's a wonderful restaurant in town that's really become a gathering space and a renovated building. This is another thing that we've seen, and I'm an architect, so this gets me really excited, is that some of these towns are rehabbing community buildings that have need a new use. And so in Sheffield, they've turned the old City Hall building, they've turned it into a meeting space and a restaurant and a wedding venue. And so these are the sorts of things that we see as big positives in some of the towns that we're looking at.
Well, and for a for-profit entity to take a leadership role like this, I mean, obviously there are people involved in the company who live in the community and care about it, but what's in it for a for-profit entity to invest in a town like that? What's the payoff for them?
So this is a great point. And what we see is that the company needs good workers. And they want their workers to have the opportunity to live in a town that they feel is a desirable place to live. And so an employer that has a town this close to it, it's sort of on the edge of the town, it really is a benefit to everybody for the company to be involved because it brings new people to town, young people, families. Sukup in particular is growing very quickly, and it has a workforce that's very diverse in terms of professionals all the way down to people who work in manufacturing. And so, this gives Sheffield a wonderful opportunity to have a range of new people coming into town. And interestingly, one of the things that's been a question mark for Sheffield is construction of new housing. And this is something they've talked to us about, that it's hard to get developers to come and want to build new properties. So this is something that the town and the company are also looking at and potentially partnering on to try to get some new housing built, because this is another aspect for the company of attracting new employees and also for the town to try to regain some population.
All right, let's talk about another community in Iowa that you've flagged as shrinking smart. Let's head way out west to Sac City. What has Sac City been doing that has set it apart?
I would say in Sac City that role of champion is very much, there's partnership, but the role of champion is very much led by the local government. So Sac City was one of the five towns that we visited where the local government is extremely active, not only in raising funds and starting new projects as the government, but also by encouraging the residents of the town, business owners especially, to raise new questions and ideas and go after new projects. So the local government acting as this catalyst or the center of discussing new ideas, going after new projects, and being open to things that might sound very difficult for a small town that size to even think about. Now, what's very important that I want to mention, not only about Sac City, but all of our smart chewing towns, is the role of partnering. So when I say in Sac City, local government is very, very active, local government would not be able to do the things that they have done in Sac City if there was no strong partnership between the local government and some of the business owners, for example, that we have in the case of Sac City. Or in Sheffield, like Kimberly was saying, the partnership between the government, local government, and Sukup Company.
This is incredibly empowering, but also, I mean, so many of these things that people have done in Sac City, in Sheffield, in other communities in Iowa are very hard, and they're also long-term projects. Is it a real challenge for communities to think long-term like that?
I would say yes, it is a very big challenge, and that's why in when we do interviews in our in other communities, what we see is that it's just so hard to even get the conversation started sometimes. So even getting that conversation started is such a big challenge, specifically because of what you just mentioned. Thinking long-term and having hope for long-term is very difficult. And that, I think, that difficulty is what really distinguishes and defines small-town champions from other types of champions that we, for example, in the urban shrinkage literature we hear about. What's important about these champions is that they are being so active, they are being so hopeful in the face of very, very little promises, in the face of so much short-term, especially short-term difficulties, as opposed to, yeah, we are going to be able to reverse the population loss, the population decline. They know that that's not going to happen in, at least in the near future, but they still focus on different measures of quality of life and say, let's go after this new exercising facility. Let's go and raise enough money to build this new daycare, which is a very, very immediate need of our community.
We have just 1 minute left. Kimberly, what's the next part of this research that you'll be doing?
Yeah, so we are analyzing our data from the interviews. We have over 60 hours of interviews, so it's a lot of material. And we are also working with a data scientist and trying to understand if there's a data analog, a kind of proxy for what we see in our qualitative data. And this is something that we're going to be working on for the next few months. And really the future for the project is that we anticipate getting more money through grants. This project has been funded by the National Science Foundation, which is really exciting for us. And we hope to go back to them and ask for a larger bit of money. And we plan to look at this issue of rural smart shrinkage in a few other states and also in some bigger communities.
Well, it's exciting, and I hope you'll come back and talk with us in the future as you find out more.
Thank you.
Kimberly Zarikor, Associate Professor of Architecture at Iowa State University, and Sarah Hamida, Assistant Professor in both Community and Regional Planning and Sustainable Environments at Iowa State University. They've been studying communities in Iowa that are shrinking smart. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Caitlin Harrop, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Dennis Reese. You can get in touch with us anytime. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're on Twitter as well, @Iowa Public Radio. I'm also there @Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.